about a decolonized practice, if you're using those terms, that's the foundation of it, I feel like. It's about understanding when you're inviting people to be part of a conversation, they might not want to be part of your conversation. So what do you have to do in order for people to want to participate in your conversation? Or maybe you have to just reframe the whole thing and be part of that conversation, potentially, possibly, or...
Hi everyone, I'm Ishwari and you're listening to the Migrants Bureau podcast.
So, tell me a bit more about today's guest and the episode.
Yeah, so today I'm speaking to Andrea Lucas-Zimmerman, and she's an artist and filmmaker. And I'm really interested in her work because she makes films about urban spaces and she tells stories of people in a very subjective way, in a way that doesn't stereotype people based on geography, class, race, or gender in the way that mainstream narrative often does.
So how did you come across her work?
I watched one of her films called A State of Reverie, which is a film that documents the area that she lived in. And it's a film made over 7 years. And in the film, she interviews intimate portraits of the residents and their own historical reenactments. And another film that of hers that I've read about is called Here for Life, which is a film about 10 Londoners. They talk about love and loss, trauma and bravery, struggle and resistance. So I'm really excited to speak to her about these two films.
That sounds really exciting. One of the things that really stuck out to me when I was listening to watching some of the trailers and listening to some of the content that was kind of already out there about the first film, mm-hmm. The Estate, A Reverie, has a really beautiful soundtrack, which it really sticks with you. I think I'd advise the listeners to kind of listen out till the end too, because it's quite a nice little moment.
Yeah. Actually, the trailer itself is a song, which I thought was really interesting. I'm also going to insert loads of sound clips from Estate of Reverie and Here for Life in the podcast.
Yeah, that's something quite different, but I think everyone will really enjoy listening to it. So I guess Ishwari, you can take it away.
So you know what they said? Time to go. It's time to go. And they emptied us out, one by one, and off we went. And how long did it take? Years, this time to go. 17 for me. And only because it was time to go did we have that kind of time. The time that we had, the living of time. And we were all in it together, so we got on with it. And there was nobody left to tell us what we could or couldn't do.
Everything's cool, basically.
Sounds good.
Cool. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us who you are, what you do at the moment, what's your work about?
So first of all, thank you for inviting me to be part of this. And I was quite excited when you've written to me, because I feel, especially within this field of architecture and urbanism, a lot has to be done still to rattle the boat. So I'm an artist and filmmaker, and I also teach and I write and I curate. But mainly my work, I think, is concerned through the moving image to try and find a space or a way of showing that which we can't easily put into words, but we recognize when we see it. So I'm very interested in the kind of, well, the shapes that in which our bodies, in a way, tell the stories that are often untold by the way we pretend we are, or how we are narrativized within the cultural sphere or the social, political, economic sphere. Yes, I'm interested in the vernacular in particular. I'm just trying to develop a whole language around that kind of way of thinking, and knowledge production through the vernacular, that is more commonly held rather than, or held in common rather than privileging one type of knowledge above another. So that's kind of the work I do. And currently I'm working on, I've just finished filming a film, with somebody who's living in a park. During the whole lockdown period, he spent the time in the park, and partly out of necessity, of course, but then also partly because it was a journey that he felt like he had to continue on rather than subject himself to the narrative which would be offered to him otherwise. And so we've made this film that was really trying to explore that, like how do we see homelessness and how do we victimize homeless people instead of giving agency to all people. So that's a project which I did just by accident the whole period. And then, yeah, developing a few more projects. And one which will be, was granted a residency with the A.M. Katan Foundation in Palestine until 2024, which is going to be really exciting to explore some of these issues on an international scale.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you come into contact with the person who was in the park, and how did you kind of build that relationship?
I think it was, I mean, mainly because I use the park every day because I have a dog and I walk the dog there several times a day. And he's the third person now over 30 years I've seen in the park. And previously, the first one was in my film Estate, A Reverie. He also had housing, but he lived on my estate. But he spent most of his time in the park, and he became kind of the focal point of a community around him. And then the second person didn't speak, but was there for a long period of time until he was no longer. And I've always been very interested in people who are there on their own terms in a different way. And then now he is somebody who I've seen over many years in different circumstances. And he's also a very well-known performance artist and musician who has just hit a different, I guess, a complex reality at this moment. And what was really beautiful, I think, for me to witness. But the interesting thing was that there were people who were taking a lot of care of him in terms of bringing food every day, were people who then, over time, and I got to know them better, also would say, you know, they would never say, oh, there's a guy who's homeless and oh, poor him or this. But they were like, oh, you know, we just want to give him some space while he's going through something. And all the people who were helping him directly were also people who've experienced extreme hardship, who became, you know, who are new to this country perhaps and had a hard time getting here and stuff like this. So it was very interesting for me, like how we narrativize as a society and like, of course, exclude therefore people from true agencies in their own realities. So subtly, but also so forcefully, right? So that's how the project emerged, really, and to and it's not expository, but it's a kind of poetic politics, I guess, of life.
Yeah, because when you speak about this narrative that people around him who know him are building this narrative, which is from a position of understanding and being almost in similar but very different situations, but in the same realm. But then there is this other narrative which is constantly going on and being bombarded, which is the media narrative or the more mainstream narrative. And I wonder how you see your work, which is so much about... So, for example, Estate of Reverie is actually one of the two films of yours that I have watched. And, for example, how that, in comparison to a more mainstream narrative, is such a in-depth and poetic understanding of what that estate was as a site and will live to be as a site. And I wonder how you see your work in relation to more mainstream and stereotypical media narratives and how that plays into your work.
It's a very good question. I think that my work is situated against almost, but not as a reaction against mainstream narratives so much, because then I would make work that is only responding to their prompts in a way. It's a refusal to be seen through these lenses. And to show the beauty, I think my skill is almost to use, to figure out how can I make a space where different languages can be spoken properly. And by different languages, I mean, not just figuratively or literally different languages, but like, where people feel they can express themselves in whichever way they want to or can. and where we find that which is common between us, but also that which is uncommon between us, right? How we encounter each other. And for me, that's the beauty of encounter of strangers, but then also how we make community together. It's not just one way. And so with Estate, for example, there was, of course, we had like a long-standing campaign against demolition of our housing block. And it was at a time when there weren't so many housing campaigns yet. It was very early on, apart from then what happened in the Haygate Estate. That was the beginning of the Haygate Estate. And they've moved so many people so far away from the neighborhood they have, some of them have grown up in, right? Or have lived for a huge chunk of their lives. And it was for us a really big, important coming together, saying we cannot let that happen on our estate. So I filmed a lot of these kind of much more expository attempts to save the estate. But then it became quite clear after a while that it would almost, again, narrativize something through an action that is relentless almost. It's relentless because it's over and over and over. And what we've learned from our campaign, for example, we have distributed that knowledge and it's been taken already on into other campaigns, which have then led to other campaigns, right? So that knowledge is not definitive. It's constantly evolving and changing if we somehow want to keep up with something. So I wanted to, therefore, I made a choice to show none of that expository stuff, but show instead the joy and celebration and sometimes also the hardship, right? It was very difficult for people, but in every instance when it was very difficult, there was an absolute refusal to be seen as a victim or mm-hmm. to be pitied. Yeah. And for me, that was crucial.
Sorry, for the listeners who don't know what Estate of Reverie is, could you say like a line about mm-hmm. what the film is about?
So Estate of Reverie is a film, is a feature-length film, which was made over 7 years on the Haggerston Estate in East London. And it was working with the residents and former residents, but also with deep history and through workshops, through long-term observation, through historical reenactments, quite unruly, wayward reenactments and imaginations to figure out how what this place meant to us. Because once we knew it was going to go, the time that became quite dense and intense. And it was a means to celebrate each other, to find each other, to look at each other's practices of living, which were really different. And also like looking at what means something to different people. Like, for example, there was a, sorry, I'm like going on tangent, but I think it explains the film quite well. There was a hairdresser on this date, which I've never before noticed properly because I obviously have a short hair, right? But then when we started filming, for the listeners, I have very short hair, so I don't use a hairdresser. And when I started filming with Helen's hairdressing salon, I realized, oh my God, her youngest client was in her 70s.
Wow.
So her salon had a very important social function for a different demography of age, right? And when that...
What was that, 1982? We often used to get power cuts, so one day I came here, it was lovely and hot. The sun was shining. I put them all under the dryer. Electric's gone. I said, come on, girls, let's get the chairs out. Put them all outside. Sat them there to dry with the sun.
Yeah.
So somebody took a photograph across the road.
Did they?
They sent it to the Hackney Gazette. Mm-hmm. And I end up in the front page.
That cannot keep up with the kind of neoliberalized or whatever, the new trendy environment and gentrified area rents. So where do these people then go afterwards? So these people no longer count within the newly imagined city, yeah, that is full of progress, but it's progress for the few, but not for everybody. And so in a way, I wanted to, you know, and Helen's hairdressing salon was amazing. Like, anyone was welcome. People brought their dogs, they would get biscuits, a tea, that people were hanging out all day. It was like, it was a social space that was incredible. As these places are when they've been there for a long time, right? There are many, many such places. And we try and kind of organize them out of the world. And so the film was in a way a resistance to that and a celebration of the mm-hmm. lives that were and could be if they were allowed.
Yeah, that's so interesting and beautiful, because even the title, Estate of Reverie, like I'm really interested in what this reverie, because reverie means a daydream, right? Maybe you can talk more about what it means to you. But this idea that, in, like you were saying, in a neoliberalized city where everything serves a purpose, there's less and less chance for encounter and less space for things to happen and for daydreams to take place, because everything serves a purpose and everything is geared towards productivity. I'm not saying this at all from an architectural point of view, because I have no clue, but in a more experiential, experiential sense. And I guess that's what gentrification does. That's what buildings that look really aspirational, there's less and less space for just being and existing. And in a way, when in that film, what you've captured are these spaces where people are just being, like the hairdressers that you were talking about. They serve a particular function, but everything around them is the function that is also being served, which is part of being human, which is part of being alive, I guess. And I would like to hear what you think of the reverie in that title.
So there were several aspects to that as well. So one was, for example, the dreaming of a future where we are not where we're not divided or seen or diminished through the postcode, the way we live, the way in which our bodies are, our social, economic, gender realities, and the way in which we could make a future or a way which communities can make and always have made in order to survive together, right? Like they had to look out for each other. So these worlds exist, but they're constantly being eroded. So we tried, so that reverie was a way of holding the space somehow, holding a memory of that space, but also acknowledging, for example, the spaces of possibilities, like on a larger ecological scale, like a lot of animals in the estate and in the film, and a lot of plants and green space and nature and tenderness and warmth and care. And on the other hand, for example, I was working with David Roberts, who was at UCL or is at UCL at Bartlett. He's teaching there. And so he brought his research as an architectural researcher on the kind of dreams of dwellings for the people to have decent housing, like the pre and post Second World War period in the UK produced a housing stock that was aspirational, right? So aspirational, that means it was for those that could afford it. So it was already the first sense, so not of gentrification, but it was a sense of cleaning up wayward spaces. On the one hand, it was this idea of cleaning up the slums and the kind of slum landlord exploitation. But at the other end of it was also a freedom that existed in some of the communities that were self-regulated. They weren't allowed to exist like that anymore. For example, small holdings or small community gatherings that looked after each other and for themselves. So they produced their own off-grid networks, so to speak. Or they didn't fit into that life, like, for example, traveling communities in this country, right? They're still struggling so much, like, and against the system of normalization, like, with quotes. And so David brought a lot of his research, and then we were starting to explore the research and what does it mean and how are we seen within the kind of narration through architectural history and social history and journalistic history. And it was really interesting. So he did a workshop in one of the flats, which was my old flat. Then as we moved out, we held these workshops to pack as many people as we could into kitchen or into the bathroom, because they were small, the kitchens and bathrooms. And in architectural history, this period of flats was narrated as, so the kitchen was for the woman, and then the rest of the family were in the rest of the flat, of course. And then Julia Vandermark, who was one of the early residents, she was born on the estate in the 1940s, and she said, oh, that's rubbish. None of us ever cooked in the kitchen. We cooked in the range cooker in the living room. And then we realized, of course, they took the beautiful range cookers out and put really cheap gas heaters in it, which, you know, when they got rid of a lot of the stuff and the butler sinks and... But there was a whole different history attached to the flats before that, which was used really differently. And unless you do a vernacular history in a way also of these places, you would not know. And that's why you need these kind of prompts, right? You need to have the scholar history, but also it questions immediately the outsider view so beautifully, right? And so this is why the workshops became an integral part also of dreaming knowledge together in a way as well. So it was on all sorts of different strategies, or we reenacted the kind of past, the aspiration of how our estate was named. So it was named after, so Samuel Richardson was a kind of very famous novelist, and he wrote two big novels in the shape of letters. So one was called Clarissa and one was called Pamela. And Clarissa was almost like a modern day soap opera. Like you could maybe see it like as a serialized soap opera. And it was super popular, and it was written, so he was deeply religious, right? And it was written in order to, I guess, to fight against the debauchery of the British morale or something at that time in 1740s or something. And so we thought, okay, so when the estate was named after these bit characters within that novel, which is massive, is still the longest novel written in the as a letter format in the English language, right? So many people have not read it. Unless you studied maybe English literature or something. It's really rare. I've hardly ever met people who've read it. And but then, so somebody must have really loved it and then named the estate like this. We couldn't find out. So David couldn't find out either who, because they the archives have lost that particular period of our history. It's somewhere maybe in some boxes, but we couldn't find it. And then we wanted to figure out, like, okay, so there was on the one hand this aspirational architecture, but it was built to last. So people were given decent housing that was beautiful, but it was also already seen as the first wave of aspirational working class, right? But then the aspiration was also inbuilt in the naming of the estate. And we thought that was really interesting. So then we did these workshops where people then were dressing up at that period in Samuel Richardson's time and trying to figure out what does it mean. And then we went to the kind of hoardings of the new promised flats once they've demolished ours, and suddenly they became luxury flats, which were now no longer future-proofing because, as you know, they're made to last not at all. Mm-hmm. They're really not necessarily built to even withstand 3 decades. And whom are they for? They're very expensive glass buildings with stock photographs that are an active erasure again of the population that actually really used to be housed in them. So our stock photographs, they had like Kate Middleton lookalikes, right? So they're like young people, affluent, aspiring young people. But anyone who looks not like that is obviously also living there, but not welcome. Mm. So it was a dreaming of like, what is our, where are our bodies? What is the future? How could we make a world that we would actually want to live in?
It was a big copper boiler. And you had to light it with a gas, light it, and then it would heat up.
And by taking away the caretaker, they're not noticing things. And if tenants are not reporting things or taking notice of certain things, then the decline starts to set in. And so, and gradually, until when, you know, things get so bad and the tenants see it and report it.
I find it interesting about the perceptions of where we've lived in, you know, and how areas change and people being embarrassed or weird about the areas that we live in. And then all of a sudden, you know, it is regarded maybe as sort of an edgy, sort of bit of a dodgy area. But then you get a lot of the hipsters coming through that then are going to photograph it. They're going to use it in their, like, you know, in their fashion lines. But they don't really live here. Mm. But they're photographing your estate and making money out of it.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that was pretty bad, actually.
So why? Really? So what?
Because
So literally, I think in 2008, just after the crisis, the financial crash happened, there were these posters everywhere. Saying benefit fraudsters, we're gonna get you. We're all across Hackney in particular, it was around. So all the kind of, and our estate looked so abandoned, right? So we were part of that. We lived in a place that was also equated with failed people. It became a failed estate. On the bigger, larger scale, all the people who weren't fitting, who were actually not responsible for the financial crash, but they became the villains of it. So there was a real interesting shift, if you think about a kind of the kind of propaganda making or the way in which the tools of the media are employed in order to scapegoat whole communities for something that they weren't part of. And that was really interesting. And then literally overnight, our council, so I was still a council tenant, put up orange boards over all the derelict flats that existed on the estate, which they had just evicted people of. And we had campaigned for, that was the third round, I think, of evictions for all the short life housing tenants. And we had campaigned every time that happened. We campaigned to fill the flats back up. But this time, so they kicked all the people out and then they put cement down the pipes, which meant that it was impossible to open them back up for low-cost housing because they literally destroyed the flats, right? And they did that in order to be able to sell the estate because it was too expensive for them to refurbish. And so we thought, oh, we're going to be privatized completely and we will all have to move out. So then we voted for transfer, majority vote for transfer to a housing association. And also, like, just to give some context, at this time our estate was so run down. I had a bucket in one of the rooms because they just never repaired the roof, so it was raining right into it and people had mold growing everywhere. My bathroom was full of mold, people with asthma. I got for the first time asthma, which is gone now again since I don't live there anymore. Kids with severe health problems. It was like, it was such a beautiful building and it could have been saved, but it was in such horrendous condition that people were just, they were tired. They were tired having to live in one room, some families. So I understood that the fight had to stop, right? And that's another interesting learning, is because from the outside you go, no, you have to fight all the way, you should squat the places. I had so many arguments with other activists around the stuff. I said, you have no idea what it's like when you have two jobs, three jobs, no job, health conditions, and you live in these kind of environments, you know, where you have to wear a hat inside when it's windy because things blow through. So they were in bad condition. And so then we thought the housing association, it was the best solution, right? That meant that they couldn't just get rid of us all. And but then, so these boards were up, these orange boards were up, and immediately, like, drug users moved in and dumping of rubbish started because people thought it was abundant. And that was another interesting thing because we all paid rent. Like, there's different generations of people who were living in this shithole suddenly, right? And whereas before we tried to really keep it nice, but then we were like, okay, that's it. We have to intervene in that. And so we did a project called I Am Here. That was the first step of making that film, actually, an engagement on the estate. And I'm Here was where we photographed all the remaining residents and some of the former residents and made kind of passport type photographs, but as large as a whole body, because the windows were really beautiful and big and the estate was facing the canal. So we had 67 images of faces looking at passers-by and without explanation, really. And we got to do that because the new housing association needed to rebrand the orange boards and made them blue. That was their brand. And we said, no, we will do this. And then so we got like this incredible support from the whole community. We got a free cherry picker. We got and the community fund paid for the photographs to be printed on and we got a really good deal. It was just it wasn't like a arts printers. It was just a commercial billboard printers, that kind of stuff. So we just found, and we had free labor from the building site opposite. It was really amazing how everyone got together because they understood what that meant to do the statement at this time. And having these faces look back at all the stuff that went on at that time, like it hasn't really gone away, right? But so we had this amazing goodwill, but that meant also that I had to get to know all the neighbors. So there were three of us leading on that project, but it became really, everyone became a stakeholder in it because we had to have 70% of approval and we had 99%. Right. Only one person said they rather had flowers, that we would paint flowers on a thing. But then in the end, they really loved it. And it became a very beautiful project because people owned the building, you know, like it was an abject building and now it was a beautiful building that was also a rebellious building. And a feisty building, and it was questioning. And suddenly history tours happened inside our estate and inside we were painting. And it was interesting because a lot of people, I didn't really realize and think about it until then, but because I grew up on a council estate, right, when I was a kid. So for me, council estates are places I always walk through. Like, I feel quite comfortable in them. But a lot of people are scared of going through them. And then suddenly it was like people coming in. And they said, oh, we would never come in before. And we were like, no, why not? And then it's like, oh, because, you know, there are estates. And then it was a real learning for me as well, like, because, I mean, it sounds crazy, but when you come from a place like that and you've always lived in a place like this, so most of my friends, right, they live in precarious housing or in, I hardly know people who own their own place. So even though, you know, I now know increasingly more these kind of people as well, but like, but it's like, you don't really think about it. And then suddenly you've become this kind of other in their eyes too. It was kind of interesting. And how do you bridge that then? And how do you encounter each other, right?
I makes it on a Sunday look all gay. With the turnip tops and cabbages, what people doesn't mind. I makes it on a Sunday look all gay. The neighbours thinks I grows them. And you'd fancy you're in Kent or at Epsom if you gaze into the mews. It's a wonder as the landlord doesn't want to raise the rent because we've got such knobby distant views.
Yeah, because it's an interesting thing of value, I guess, like suddenly something that no one cares about or nobody even looks twice at becomes something that just holds this strange value. But then at what cost are you doing that? It's literally someone else's life. So with estate, it was your home, you know, like it was yours. But have you found that in other films that you've made? Has it been similar relationships working with people, or have you had to find communities to work with? How has that process been?
I think both. So, for example, in the most recent film, which was the Art Angel produced film Here for Life, which I made in collaboration with Adrian Jackson, who runs Cardboard Citizens, which is a theatre company. And the theatre company working with people on risk of homelessness or former homelessness, and working with a very radical, beautiful theatre practitioner's ideas or philosophy called Auguste Boal, which is the theatre of the oppressed, which I find very interesting and you probably know. But and Therese Henningsen, who is a long-term collaborator, and Tina Gallis, who is my cinematographer, also a long-term collaborator. We're working on this project with 10 people, and it's really interesting because I felt like I don't really think about it until after, but in this project, both Adrian and I, we knew we wanted to work with trying to explore London today and what does London mean today for people who are surviving, and to find, because both of our experiences working with people like his and his company and me and with his estate and other projects here are that our London experience are quite different from mainstream narrative of like London is so hard, it's so tough. Yes, it's hard and tough and it's horrendous with its rents and stuff, but the survival of people and the possibility it also offers are that which has to be made visible, I think, in a way, in order to resist again like
Stallions.
This.
3, 2, 1. Back off! Back off!
You fish fish, you don't hunt fish.
This is the semantics of it. You know what we mean. The fish are going
no,
around.
No, it's not to
and
do
you
with
go
semantics.
After them. You go after them with
Wait,
sharp
listen,
objects.
It's not an argument.
No, it's not an argument. Sorry, I don't mean my voice to sound like I was
an open discussion.
My voice sounds
loudy, right? Like my reverie was a response also to this fake dream making of luxury flats and come to London and there's this whole experience that you can buy into if you have enough money. So we knew we wanted to make this film and looking at mechanisms of survival, but also like a with a fictional approach where people could, so instead of working from the documentary ground up and making fictional reenactments. We wanted to work from a fictional ground, but using the real to explore these questions, but through making art together in an overt way, because we brought together a group of people that didn't know each other. So when you work with people who don't know each other, and yeah, we could have made a film that would have been about the encounter of each other, but that's in a way artificial, I felt like, because they only came together because of this film, and it's not like a Big Brother kind of episode I'm interested in making. Do you know what I mean? So it was like, okay, we from the right premise, let's make art together, because that's the other thing. Like, I feel like art and poetry and representation and the power of representation is so strong, and it's also hijacked by an industry often. That's what it's called, the film industry, the theater industry, right? And it imagines our lives in certain ways. So we wanted to see across class and across gender, race, and ability to make this work together, that ask the right questions where our bodies are just allowed to be. And then we did that. And we did that also, and it took 5 years all in all, which wasn't planned either. But it just sometimes things take a long time, because then you need to take time out. And then when you're working with so many people, then their life happens. So some people had to go away for a while, or they had difficult moments and we wanted to wait for them. And then, so it just took a while. And then we found this place in the nomadic, in just off of Liverpool Street. It's called the Nomadic Gardens and Nomadic Community Gardens, that doesn't exist anymore. So it was just closed down and sold. And it was kind of a temporary autonomous zone in a way, where it was self-policing and it had many different things going on. It was a very welcoming place, and it was a very diverse place, like diverse in its positive sense rather than the word it has become. Like, I think everything has been hijacked, like language is hijacked so much. But how do we make a space? And these are really interesting questions, because you can't just delegate that making of space by hiring a lawyer. Like those, mm-hmm. again, who are the most wealthy, they just hire intermediaries so they don't have to touch you in any way, right? But those of us who cannot do that have to touch each other in some way, and we have to make the world work for each other, and that's not easy. And so anyway, so it was following that model, and it was embracing that model, and it meant that sometimes it was hard for them, but with our working together, it just meant like we had to give something back. We were working in that space, but we also brought stuff to the space. Mm-hmm. So it was an exchange, right? It wasn't just an extractive way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is something that I've been thinking a lot about. It's so good to hear you talk about it in this way, which it's not just like one or two people working together. It's entire like communities who come together, and there is an exchange, mm-hmm. and drawing on from aspects of ways in which people have already been working together and forming like alliances, and using that into making an artwork to tell a story. Because I'm curious about what is your relationship, or how do you see migration? I'm sure you've worked with like loads of migrant communities and in your usual working in urban spaces, so how do you relate to that and how do you see that?
So in the work that I've done, it's not necessarily explicitly done with certain communities, but the communities are often different communities and different experiences and different realities are part of the people I work with, or are part of the groups of people I work with. There are these people with different experiences. Like in my last project, for example, I did a lot of research with into organizations that help people with no recourse to public funds, that was part of the research into that film Here for Life. And so one of the people we met through this research became one of the actors that we worked with. Yeah, so it's more like that. And the estate I lived on, there were the majority of people. We had probably almost all of the world living on this estate, you know? And I'm also like I'm not from here. And so it's about, we have to make the world that we have, because it belongs to all of us and none of us in a way, right? And even the people who have been born and bred, like these are really interesting narratives for me right now. Like So like born and bred, and I mean, at what point do you belong to a place, you know? And at what point is it yours? And these are these really big questions that are very difficult questions. Like, when are you in, when you're out? What does it mean to be in? What does it mean to be out? Whom do you exclude? So I've often really not used the word community. I often use temporary community, because communities also are exclusive in so many ways, but at the same time, they're needing, necessary for survival, a different type of community, right? But if you're talking about some communities, they will always exclude others, so they can protect their own bubble of privilege, let's say. And that's what I'm critical towards in relation to the understanding of that kind of community. But then there are, you know, formed communities that are really enabling. And on our estate, for example, our old estate, there were these food co-op. There was a food co-op since the 1970s. And so one of the clips of a food co-op is in Estate of Reverie in the film. And the food co-op was set up by people because the people on this estate always had not very much. So it was a sink estate in a larger sense all its life. And even during the Booth map, when Charles Booth did the kind of mapping of the poverty and wealth of London, where the new estate was built was already in its darkest color, like abject and full of criminals. And then the estate was built, and now it's obviously a luxury location for luxury flats, right? And so the first time when there was a food co-op established on the estate, a lot of the people who were shop owners were then pitted against this little food co-op, one food co-op for the people who have the least, and it was volunteer run. And then other people who are trying to survive, have very little, but have a little bit more, are pitted against those who have even less, instead of finding solidarity, you know. And so these are very sad, but also learning moments where you can see, okay, what can we do in order to see that there's actually not competition, but it's an enabling. So this is why these kind of questions were in the film as well, and trying to make sense of place and location and human encounters, but also different life experiences, because some people, it was immediately again, that, you know, just to, sorry, I'm jumping, but like on our estate, we had six pubs, and all the six pubs were for different communities. So one was for the Caribbean community, one was for the Irish community, one was for the anarchist community, one was for, so there were all these different places. And then there were also the ones which were mixing. So you already had like this very microcosm of amazingness, and then you also had the possibility of combustibility, which was then politicized and used. So, you know, so it's an ongoing process, I suppose, of community making and working with people who've had different life experience, some of which may have been very extreme, and you don't see it. All you see is the people who might not be so friendly to you, but they might just come from somewhere where they've seen the absolutely worst mm-hmm. of humanity, right? So for me, these kind of works are also opening up spaces for people to share some of their experiences and life experiences, and a holding for each other, a holding of non-understanding necessarily trauma or stuff.
Yeah, and I think the way that you were talking about different vernaculars and different languages, I guess not everyone can or wants to talk about trauma, wants to express joy even through talking. And I think it's especially in the context of a city where everything is just already so overwhelming, and there's so many softer or different ways of expression which are also languages and knowledges of the people that live there. And yeah, like, how do we talk about them without explicitly talking about them, because talking itself can be quite limiting. Also, what was interesting was, like, when going back to when you were talking about how much do you like overlap and how much do you separate, and the and almost like the opacity in telling stories from a perspective which can never be our own, is like interesting to think about in relation to what you're saying.
I think that what you just raised, I want to say, because I think this is really interesting, because I've learned from, after making a state, and I did quite a few talks with it, and then sometimes people would say, oh, but how do you work on an estate? Because I work on an estate and then people don't want to work with me. They say, oh, we have these problems. And it's also like, what do you have to offer the conversation, and how do you make a conversation properly, a conversation rather than your, it's on your terms as the maker. And right. That's a really hot, and that's a really difficult one. And I think this is like, if you talk about a decolonized practice, using those terms, that's the foundation of it, I feel like. It's about understanding when you're inviting people to be part of a conversation, they might not want to be part of your conversation. So what do you have to do in order for people to want to participate in your conversation? Or maybe you have to just reframe the whole thing and be part of their conversation, potentially, possibly, or... what is it that you're offering? What is it that you're giving? And I think those kind of processes need a lot of time and consideration, so you're not just a tourist in another person's life. And often funding structures are not conducive to that, because they want you to enable, or they want you to make work relatively fast, and you don't have that long-term engagement, which sometimes is necessary, or especially if you're trying to make a space that is outside of your own realm. I think it's possible to do, but you will have to have time.
I was very well pleased with what I knowed, and I reckoned myself no fool, till I met with a maid on the Brooklyn Road who turned me back to school, singing low down with a little green lantern shine. Oh, maid, so you've done with the all but one, and she can never be mine. 'Twas right in the midst of a hot June night, with thunder dancing round, I spied her face by the fairy light that beats from off the ground. She owned.
What do you kind of imagine, subjective storytelling that you would want in the future to look like?
I can talk more concretely perhaps about what I will do in the future in relation to my own work and what I'm exploring. So my next larger film is without any dialogue at all, and it's with seven people, and it's exploring trauma, but in a really different way than we would think about trauma. It's more as a sense of repair, but like a very fiery repair. And then the other longer project, which I'm just starting, and that's going to be really exciting actually for me to think through how to work in the context of my residency, my upcoming residency in long-term engagement in a kind of international setting around the questions of home and belonging. Among geopolitical sense, but without discounting the human and the human body and experience, and not simply reiterating expected narratives. So that's a challenge that I will need to learn a lot in order to make this work with the people who are going to be in it, which I don't yet know whom they are going to be. You know, but that's the kind of an approach, and I have a few years to do that, 4 years. So... yeah, it's like constantly, I want to make work that engages with these questions, but also that allows these dialogues to come to fruition, I think, because we need each other, I feel like, to make another world and to imagine another world. We need us to work together to do that, to come with these different ideas and like also rupture our ideas and our thoughts. Yeah, that's all that I'm striving to that. And same with my educational practice. So this all goes hand in hand. It's like I'm questioning, probing, rupturing, but also, yeah, trying to be curious and open for the moments where activism might still make a difference, which at the moment I feel like very conflicted about. I'm so despaired on so many levels, right? Like we all are. But then, there's also a lot of fire there still. So
I was very well pleased with what I knowed, and I reckoned myself no fool, till I met with a maid on the Brooklyn Road, who turned me back to school, singing low down, where the little green lantern shine. Oh, maid, so you've done with the all but one, and she can never be mine.
Wow, there's so much to think about after that conversation. If you want to watch more of Andrea Luca Zimmerman's films, she does a lot of screenings and events online and around. We have mentioned a few links to her upcoming events and screenings in the description of our social media posts about this episode. But also make sure to keep an eye around for more to come. Thank you for listening.
If you like what you hear, then make sure you follow us on social media. It's My Conspiracy and Everything. That's Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and even Facebook. Yes, we still use Facebook. We curate our content voluntarily and would like to keep the discussions flowing. You can contribute what you would like to our PayLink account via paypal.me/MyGaspiro. We thank you in advance and look out for the next episode. Stay tuned.